Jason Stark film.
Baseball Hall of Famer Jason Stark.
And then the robot said, strike.
That's why you're going in the Hall of Fame.
It's an inside the park home run, Doug Glanville.
Mike Trout is coffee at Starbucks with a double latte, skinny.
Doug, are you ready to make some podcast magic?
I am ready. Bring on the magic wand. Let's do it.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville. I'm Jason Stark. I write about baseball for The Athletic. And I'm joined, once again, by my good friend, writer, broadcaster, professor, distinguished former major leaguer, world traveler, and the voice of Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN Radio, Doug Glanville. Doug, how are you, my friend? How was your journey to historic Fenway Park?
Oh, outstanding. You know, the two classic teams with the two classic stadium. That is really fun to watch, you know, history unfold. And I didn't have to take a red eye. So I'm still delirious, but I'm not as delirious as I would have been.
Well, good. I know you didn't get much sleep, but nothing new there. As for me, Doug, dealing with some plumbing stuff here. I don't know about you. It feels to me that when water is gushing through your ceiling, that's not a great thing. Would you concur?
Well, unless you're, you know, going out to the ocean, maybe. If you have a boat, maybe it's fine. But in this case, I'd say no.
Yeah. Seems more like a house than a boat, but I could look into that and get back to you. I don't know. Anyway, we have another fun show ahead of us. One of our favorite people, Jim DeShays of Marquee Sports Network, will join us to talk about the Cubs and the future of starting pitching and what I feel like is his uncanny resemblance as a baseball player to Shohei Ohtani. Of course, we've all noticed that. We'll have some Yankees-inspired strange but true nuggets for you. And one of the most inventive trivia questions I think any of our listeners has ever asked us. Plus, we'll have more on the shocking change of mayoral regimes that took place last week in Starkville City Hall. But all that is coming up later. Doug, are you ready to make more podcasting magic?
I'm ready, absolutely. And I'll swim through your basement to get there.
Doug, it's always a treat when we get to welcome in this week's special visiting luminary in Starkville. It is our good friend and one of the very best baseball analysts in our land, breaking down the Cubs on Marquee Sports. Let's welcome in the always entertaining Jim DeShays. Jim, welcome back to Starkville.
It's always a pleasure to be in Starkville. Never had a bad time in Starkville.
That's right. Doug, you know, Jim hasn't merely visited Starkville. He's also co-hosted Starkville back when you were off doing something way more important a couple of years ago. So, Doug, if you ever get tired of doing this, Stark and JDville, I think it has an excellent ring to it, don't you think?
Yeah, you know, you just put a couple of periods there between JD and then maybe JDS. Yeah, you'd have to come up with a little different title due to licensing issues. But yeah, we have to give him more than a statue. We've given everybody a statue. So we have to go next level. Maybe like a cloud. We could name a cloud after him above Starkville.
Yeah.
Maybe a star.
Yeah, a star. We could do that. Yeah.
Doug, like you're in charge of all that. So get on it.
Okay. I am.
All right. So before we get started here, I need some plumbing tips. We've had a plumbing debacle here at my house. We were debating, a friend of mine and I, whether it was a plumbing debacle or a plumbing fiasco. If you had either of those, what would you guys do?
Okay, well, I'd make sure my insurance was paid up because we've had a couple of debacles at our place over the many years. And so much so that we are now on double secret probation from the insurance company where we have to have these water cops in our house, these little devices that if they get wet, it just shuts the water down.
Whoa.
We had frozen pipes that burst while we were out of town. So, and we've had a couple such episodes. It's not a lot of fun, Jason, as you know.
So is that why Jim just gave me a tip off air too, Doug? He suggested that I call Ed Norton. And Norton's busy. He's tied up with a suing job right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I just thought he might freelance a little bit on the side.
Yeah, Ed might do that. Ed, you know, well, I always try to. I like to think positively, and you know, say you know, make lemonade out of lemons. I say you get a pool. You have an indoor pool. You just like take the water, redirect it, and just think like differently. You know, just turn your basement into a swimming pool, and you're good to go.
Yeah, I had one of those last night actually. But I had some really enjoyable wet vacuuming. So you can no longer wait around in it. It's just a little damp. So there's people in this house right now taking care of that. So if it gets noisy, you'll understand. Okay.
Well, we'll understand. We're good.
All right. Anyway, enough about my problems. Jim, let's start this conversation by asking if there is a word to describe the Cubs' April 17-0 losses in Fenway, notwithstanding. What is it?
Well, the word I've heard many other people use, and I guess I would agree with it, would be resilient, because they've endured a lot of injuries and they're still playing winning baseball. The depth has really been tested. Opening day starter Justin Steele went down on opening day. He hasn't pitched since. Kyle Hendricks on the IL with a back. Seiya Suzuki's missing time with an oblique. Cody Bellinger's hurt. It's one of those things that you might be easier to list all the healthy guys than all the guys that dealt with some kind of injury. But despite that, you know, they've managed to play winning baseball. You know, this kid Imanaga from Japan has been brilliant. Javier Assad's pitched well. So the depth has surely been tested, and they've been good.
You know, and where do you put the fact that major change, new manager, Craig Counsell comes in? I mean, what do you think he's brought to the fact that, you know, they are where they are right at this moment?
Yeah, you know, it's always hard, right, to quantify, you know, what exactly a manager brings to the table. I just know that in my interactions with him and what I've heard from other people that are around him a lot more than I am, that he's really good, very thoughtful, very smart. Doesn't seem to be any panic. You know, he kind of gets it. Great communicator. You know, how much that translates into wins and losses, I don't know. I just know, and I knew him a little bit before he came over here, and I knew the reputation, and I've not seen anything to lead me to believe that it's not all legit, that the reputation is well-deserved. I love the fact that every time you ask him a question, there's like a pause. You know, he's not spouting off something that's scripted, like you get coach speak from so many different people in sports. It's always well thought out, and he's super prepared. But I think he's also a guy who knows sometimes he doesn't have all the answers, right? And there's a humbleness there too that I appreciate.
You know, Jim, I looked up something amazing about that guy a few weeks ago for the my Numbers That Define Baseball column. There's a metric in our sport now known as expected one-loss record. And if you look at Craig Counsell's expected one-loss records through the years, his teams have won more games than they were expected to win every season since 2017. And this year, Cubs are doing it again. Should be 15-13, actually 17-11, so two games better. So if he were to do that again over a full season, he would join only three other managers in the expansion era who did it in eight in a row or more. Joe Torre with the Yankees was one. Mike Socia with the Angels was the second. Clint Hurdle with the Pirates was third. So like, here would be my question. I've been thinking about this ever since. Is this just fun with numbers? Or is there something about Craig Counsell where he always is able to get more out of his teams than the numbers say should actually be there?
Yeah. And that's the great question. And that's when he was hired by the Cubs. That's one of the things that Jed Hoyer talked about, that, you know, watching this guy from the other side, he always seemed to find a way to win games. I know their record in one run games last year was really good. Me, like most people, like a lot of people that really study the game, tend to dismiss that. That's not a repeatable skill. If you win a bunch of one run games one year, the next year, you're probably not likely to do that. But at some point, as you're alluding to, if you do it year after year after year after year, then you start to think, maybe there's something there. Maybe there's something, some secret sauce that this guy has that nobody else has or very few others have had over the years. I don't know. You know, people will point to the fact that he had really good bullpens in Milwaukee, and maybe that contributes to winning one-run games. But one-run games come in all different shapes and sizes, right? Sometimes it's close the whole game, and you eke it out 3-2. Sometimes it's 7-2, and you rally and score 6 runs and win 8-7. You know, I don't know the answer, Jason. I don't know why that is the case, but the fact that it is the case is intriguing.
It really is. You know, a few weeks ago, we did our season preview show around here, and I think Doug might remember this. I'm going to say right now it was my greatest preseason prediction ever. That bar's not set that high, but the category was pick a pitcher to win the Cy Young Award this year, but you can't pick one of the usual suspects. So, Doug, who did I pick in the National League? I'm sure you remember this.
Was that Clayton Kershaw? I think it was Kershaw.
No, that's a crummy guess.
Make him squirm, Doug.
Yeah, you want me to just reveal this?
Yeah, make the reveal. Big reveal.
Okay, it was Shota Imanaga, right? He was my pick. And he's currently 4-0 with a 0.98 ERA. So if you guys need me to pick like some Powerball numbers for you, I'm good with that.
Kentucky but, Derby's coming up pretty soon here.
It is. Yeah, I'll get back to you on my Kentucky Derby pick. Jim, is it cool for us to describe Imanaga as a Deshaies-type left-hander?
In some respects, yeah. You know, I pitched up in the zone. He pitches up in the zone. He has way better command than I had. He doesn't walk anybody. And, you know, I was a high fastball changeup guy. He's a high fastball splitter guy. So they have some similarities. His fastball's better than mine was, but it's still not, he's not a high octane guy. He's 92, 93 for the most part. Every now and then you'll see him touch 94, maybe even hit 95, but typically pitches about 92, 93, which in this modern era of baseball is, you know, average or maybe a tick below average, which is mind boggling. But yeah, he's got that game. He works the top of the zone and then complements it with that good split finger pitch.
Yeah. And is there, I guess, anything too, you mentioned the velocity, just watching someone who kind of pitches, you know, below sort of what he could max out on. I mean, do you see like a correlation to like what actually plays in terms of actually having that kind of command?
Yeah, you know, and it's the other thing, Doug, that's interesting. You know, I was always taught, and I think pitchers of my generation, even if you pitched up in the zone, it was like you start down and then you climb the ladder, right? You throw strike one down in the zone, then you get guys to expand up. I think with the modern high fastball guy is doing, and Shota is for sure, is kind of just living up there a lot, like pounding the top of the zone and just above the zone and getting swings and misses or lazy fly balls. So, and it speaks to all the data that's out there now where, you know, clubs tell their guys, this is what you do best, so do it a whole bunch. You have an effective high fastball, so throw a lot of them. And that's what he's been able to do.
You know, speaking of pitching, I wanted to ask you about what might be the hottest topic in baseball right now, and that is the inability of teams to keep anybody healthy, any pitchers. Cubs are like an incredible example. I think Imanaga is the only member of the on-paper opening day rotation who actually hasn't been hurt, right? So, Jim, you made over 250 starts in the big leagues, 12 seasons pitching in the big leagues. What was your secret to staying healthy that maybe pitchers today have lost the feel for?
Yeah, I don't know. I think guys throw so hard now, and it puts stress on their arms. You know, we didn't have to deal. I mean, people got hurt back then, but not to the degree they are now. So I don't know. There's a billion theories, right? Guys need to throw more in the minor leagues. They're being coddled. They're not prepared to come up here and pitch. I'm not sure I buy that. Guys are trying to max out velocity, and they shouldn't do that. Well, that's how you get hitters out. You make a lot of money by throwing 100 miles per hour. It's kind of hard to ask them not to do that. So we're at this kind of weird point where we're mad about the fact that pitchers can't pitch deeper into games and pitch more innings. And then we're mad about the fact they get hurt when they do pitch more. And I feel like we're kind of, didn't seem like years ago, and I'm not a big NFL guy, that you know, running backs just, okay, we're going to get 4 years out of a running back and then we're going to move on because they get beat up. And I feel like that's the way starting pitching is going now. Like, we're just trying to max these guys out, get as much out of them as we can. And they might get hurt. And if they do, you just have to have depth. You have to have plan B, C, and D to come in because a couple guys are going to go on the IL. Somebody might need surgery and be done for the year. So I don't know if we go to a six-man rotation, pitch once a week, you know, whatever it is, something has to give. But I don't know the answer. I think it's probably tied to velocity, but, you know, I'm not a doctor. And it might be spin, right? Guys are trying to spin breaking balls at, you know, at a high velocity with all kinds of action on it. So that's probably part of it too.
You know, it's funny that you mention running backs, because I was talking about this with a pitcher a couple weeks ago, and he said to me, like, how can you tell me not to try to make guys swing and miss? He said, does anybody tell running backs in the NFL not to gain as many yards as they can, not to run as hard as they can? Can't tell us not to throw as hard as we can. So I raised this to one of the people in baseball who I know is brainstorming this whole deal. And he said, what a great example, because like when we were kids, like the running backs were legends. They carried the ball every play. Now what happens? Now it's running back by committee. You can't even name the starting running back on half the teams in football, and they're all banged up and out of the game in a year and a half. And like, I don't know that it's an exact parallel, but it was an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah. So, I mean, is there an argument to be made that teams should be on the lookout now for sinker slider guys who pitch to contact, kind of like reversing the trend? And is there any evidence to suggest that those guys stay healthy? And even though they might not be able to put up the gaudy numbers that high velocity pitchers do, they might be able to pitch competitively for a long number of years. And there may be value to have a couple of those guys in your rotation and kind of cycle through the other guys. I don't know.
You're going to have to pay pitchers for volume, right? For innings. That's what's going to have to change. Maybe it's already happening. I mean, Zach Wheeler has never won a Cy Young, but he got $43 million a year. So, I mean, he's given you dominance and innings and volume. And I think the volume part was a huge reason for that. Don't you think, Doug?
Yeah. I mean, you talk about attacking the zone I think I'm, you know, curious from JD's experience that, you know, if you watch, you know, how pitchers are developed, or just, I guess, your secret sauce of how you approach the game. You know, I go back to Ron Darling, wrote a great book called The Complete Game. And what was cool about it is it's nine innings, right? And he gives you kind of a sense of the mentality for each inning to make it through. And I feel like it's very different than how Darling describes it today, because you're not even thinking about that, right? You're not trying to get, I mean, what was it in the mentality of the pitchers you were around And when you pitch to think about, I'm trying to go nine, I'm trying to make, you know, is there a sort of a whole psychological or a strategic approach that maybe you don't see as you cover the game?
I think some pitchers were good enough where they could, you know, I'm going to try to use my fastball first time through the order as much as possible. I'm going to save something in my back pocket, whether it's a breaking ball or a changeup, not let the hitter see it. I don't feel like I was ever that guy. I think I needed to use all my pitches from pitch number one. Now, I mean, I followed the catcher for the most part. So if Alan Ashby was calling that game, he might say, no, that's not what we did. We did definitely try to, you know, save something. And the other thing about my generation, there just wasn't as much power in the lineups. So you could feel pretty comfortable, you know, maybe with a one or two hole hitter, or certainly with the 8-9, you know, maybe even 7-8-9. Being a little bit more aggressive, because, you know, they might hit a base hit off you, but they weren't likely to do damage. So I think pitching to that extent, it was easier, might not be the right word, but it was less dangerous. There was less power in the game, so you didn't have to generate swing and miss as much. But now, because these lineups are so stacked and there's so, you know, so many guys can hit the ball out of the ballpark, there is that emphasis on swing and miss and throwing a 98 mile an hour fastball if you have it, or snapping off, you know, god awful slider that maybe puts a little extra stress on the elbow, but, you know, you can't afford to leave it in the zone because you're afraid somebody's going to clobber it. I think that's part of it too. But to circle back to your question, I don't think I was a guy, but certainly there were in that generation. There were guys would tell you, yeah, I pitched with my fastball first time through the order. Then I was sprinkling some breaking balls later on. Identify who the dangerous guys in the middle of the order that you're going to pitch around because you're going to attack some other guys. Maybe I just wasn't smart enough, like Ronnie, you know, not an Ivy League guy like Darlin.
Well, it's funny because I remember talking to Curt Schilling because all the years of just playing behind him. And I always noticed like 93, 94, 92, 90, you know, and then every once in a while you'd see 97. Like, so I was like, where's this come from? Right. So I asked him one day, like Curt, like what, where does that come from? Like, why can't you do that all the time? And he said, I could do that three times a game. Remember, he gave like a number, like there's three moments I'd pick my spots for Derek Jeter. And that's what I would do. But if I did that all the time, I wouldn't make it. So I just thought that was like kind of a moment of shock. Like, oh, okay. You know, yeah, you don't max effort, because he associated it with longevity. And also, not only in a career, but in a game or a season.
I played with Ryan for 3 years down in Houston, and that didn't happen. That wasn't his program. He was trying to throw every fastball as hard as he could, and he was trying to throw every curveball as nasty as he could, and he pitched till he was 46. So, but you can't use that. You can't use guys like Ryan as the example, right? Because they're such an outlier. That's kind of the argument you get into with a lot of people. Oh, back in the day, Ryan did this, and Fergie Jenkins did that. You know, well, yeah, they're all the same. Right. It's a little different.
Okay, but you guys are dancing around a really big topic, so let's just go there. I feel like one of baseball's biggest challenges as an entertainment product is to somehow restore some semblance of the prominence that starting pitchers always had in the game. And the way to do that is to figure out a way to stop the parade every night of bullpen guys throwing 98 by like somehow finding a way to incentivize teams to keep their starting pitchers in the game beyond like the fifth inning. So Jim, if I made you the king of baseball, how would you do that?
Well, you could limit the number of pitchers on your roster so you didn't have as many relievers available on the nightly. You know, you could even limit the number of pitchers available every night. But you could have like a taxi squad so that you had fresh arms available. So, you know, you worried about hurting people. Because I'm with you. When we were kids, you know, I grew up an hour and a half from Montreal, and we'd look in the paper and you'd see the probables coming up, and we go, hey, Dad, Seaver's pitching against the Expos, you know, in three nights. Let's go. You know, we went to games because of who the starting pitchers were.
Right.
I don't know that people do that anymore. So, you know, again, could you go to when it makes sense for these guys to pitch once a week? But there's a chance if they're pitching once a week, they might be able to go out there and give you eight innings or maybe nine innings and have that dominant performance. The bottom line is that might not help you be a better team, right? And these guys are all trying to win games. That's the rub. I don't know.
Yeah, somebody actually said to me last week, what if Friday night in Baltimore was Corbin Burns night? You could always buy, just like college, he's the Friday night starter. So you could always buy tickets for Friday night knowing Corbin Burns is going to pitch. Whatever it costs, we're going to do that. It's an interesting concept. I don't know if it's the answer, but like there's just a lot of stuff floating around there that I think baseball needs to dig into. And then the other thing that I think the sport has to figure out at some point is how to reduce the strikeout rate so the ball's in play a lot more. And Jim, I know you had a brilliant idea for how to do that and to attack the three true outcomes epidemic by moving back the mound, but also raising the fences. Could you please tell everyone in Starkville how that would work?
Well, but it didn't work, right? Didn't they try it in like an independent ball? They moved
the Atlantic League. Yeah. They moved the mound back.
It was a disaster.
It was a disaster because everybody hated it. Pitchers hated it. Hitters hated it. One of the most incredible quotes I ever got was doing that story. A guy who was a hitter in the Atlantic League was just, you know, he and another guy in his team were just ranting about all the different experiments going on. And I said, do you ever feel like you guys are guinea pigs with all this stuff? And he said to me, guinea pig is the right analogy because you know how you have a pet guinea pig and then he dies and nobody cares, well, that's us.
just get a new guinea pig.
Right. But the upshot was it didn't help offense. If you throw a breaking ball that breaks 14 inches, now it's breaking 18 inches, right? And so that wasn't good. There was more time on the fastball, but there was also more time for if your fastball had life to move
all over the place, yeah.
You know, so it really didn't help. And all the hitters even hated it because they thought, who's going to want me in the big leagues if I hit in this league when the mounds are back a foot? The whole thing was a mess.
Yeah, but if you either move the walls back, make them higher, make it harder to hit home runs, incentivize guys getting on top of the ball and hitting line drives and going back to, I mean, you could deaden the ball. You could try to create some version of baseball. You don't want to go back to the dead ball era. But if you could do something to suppress the power in the game and make contact and speed a priority, then it changes the nature of the game. 3 or 4 years ago, here in New York City, where I am now, I went for a walk in Central Park, and there was a rec league softball game going on. And I'm watching it, I'm going, and this was before the pitch clock. I'm thinking, this is more fun to watch than our game. The ball was constantly in play, and people were running around the bases, and people were getting thrown out on the bases. And it was like, this, I was really digging it. I said, we need to create a sport where this happens. So I think to that end, you know, they're trying, right? The pitch clock, I think, helps. It's faster, but it doesn't. Yeah, has it chopped away at the strikeout rate?
So if they raise the fences, how much would you raise them?
Whatever. Well, I mean, you'd leave it up to the individual. There would be a mandate that it had to be at least so high. Then you could go as high as you want. You could.
You have a yellow monster, red monster, blue monster, green. Just do the whole rainbow.
I used to have a theory about Yankee Stadium that the fences at Yankee Stadium went up or down depending on who was hitting. Okay, like when the Yankees hit it, they went down. When the other team would hit, they'd go up.
So that's like home field advantage.
So you could do that. Like if Aaron Judge is up, you raise it all the way to the second deck.
Yeah, you get like three a game where you can push a button and the ball just comes up and like, you know, these lights flash, you know.
You don't want like a Vince Coleman incident with the tarp, you know, rolling on you or something. Someone's like, I'm stuck on the wall. Press the button.
like a Game of Thrones. The wall just rises up. And
it's like, there's dragons in the sky.
Baseball needs more creative thinkers like us. That's for sure.
Yes. Let's get us a sit down with Rob, would you? And see if we can hammer this out.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out. So, JD, you mentioned the pitch clock, and I guess what has been your sort of, especially on the announcing side as well, like what's your sort of reaction to it as it's been in play a couple years?
Yeah, a big fan. I think the quality of the game, just because of the pace of play, has improved greatly. I'm all for it. There are times as a broadcaster where you're like, wow, I wish we had a little more time to, you know, speak to this replay or tell this story that we were telling, but the inning ended because it was just moving along so quickly. But that's a trade-off I'm willing to accept. I think fans like it. At least the feedback I get from fans is that they really like the pitch clock. I know some pitchers had issues with it, but I think for the most part, guys have made the adjustment and you don't hear too much grousing about it anymore. I know some wonder if it's contributing to pitcher injury. I don't know if I accept that either. I don't know. I don't necessarily buy that, but I can't dismiss individual pitchers' concerns. I understand that, but overall, I think it's a big plus.
You know, I feel like we've spent way too much time on this show talking about serious stuff. So I think it's time to play America's favorite game, Know Your Jim Deshays Trivia. Jim, would you like to play that game?
I'm in, yeah.
All right.
Okay. You ready? First question. Jim Deshays, you won 61 games for the Astros and 17 games for the Twins. Only three other starting pitchers in history have won at least 10 games for both of those teams. You think you can name them?
That's interesting.
Wow. Is Mark Portugal one?
Mark Portugal's one?
Oh,
yeah.
I'm a winner already.
You win.
You're way ahead of this game. One of these guys is like kind of active. He was in spring training this year with a club. I don't think he is at the moment.
It's funny.
I know he's not an active big leaguer at the
moment. I would have a better chance probably naming somebody from the 80s than I would currently.
Okay, well, there is a guy from the 80s, so.
Rats.
Left-hander.
Left-hander. Astros Twins. Was he a teammate of mine at some point?
I never looked that part up. When initials?
Yes.
How about GS?
Not George Samus. Because he's TS and he's not. GS. Gary.
Did he play University of Texas? University of Texas. I mean, I'm just throwing.
Yeah, Greg Swindell.
Greg Swindell is correct. And you have no idea on the third?
No clue.
Guarantee you've watched this guy pitch. Jake Odorizzi is the other.
I would not have gotten that though.
Okay, so that part of Know Your Jim Duches trivia didn't go that well. Let's keep going.
Portugal.
I'm giving myself a solid B for that.
That's a good pull. You
do get bonus points for that. Or D-. No doubt. Here's a topic I know you've been waiting for me to bring up. You're hitting. Okay, so as you know, you hold an all-time major league record that is guaranteed never to be broken. You want to tell the people what it is?
Yeah, it would be most at-bats without an extra base hit.
Right. 440 career plate appearances for Jim Duches, ladies and gentlemen. No extra base hits. We've only spent about, 900 hours discussing that topic. But here's one for you. I think you're going to get this. Can you name the only other player in history with more than 400 plate appearances and no extra base hits?
Wow.
I tracked him at one point.
I know for a period of time, Frank Castillo was making a run at me. I don't know. Is Frank Castillo the answer?
He's just short. He was 394. Wow. This guy's a little more recent than Frank Castillo.
Wow. Somebody else got within that window.
Somebody got this close to you and you weren't aware of it?
Oh, yeah.
I blame myself for this.
I was just going to say, it's your fault. This is your department. You should have notified me.
That's right.
I would have been on watch. No.
Another left-hander.
So fairly recently active.
One ace Cy Young.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cy Young Award winner. Lefty.
Okay, I'll try to figure it out.
Longtime National Leaguer, right? You had to be in there.
Although probably more renowned for his American League heroics than what happened when he went to the National League.
Oh, really? Wow.
They pitched a long time.
So this one's not going that well either.
lefty, incompetent hitter, American League or National League.
Went to the National
League. Give me a club or two that he was on.
Bay Area.
Oh, Barry Zito.
Barry Zito. Correct. 418 plate appearances.
Wow.
No extra base hits. So he was only 22 short of you.
Why did he retire? I mean, he had a shot.
Yeah. I don't think he was in it for his hitting. For some reason, I don't.
Maybe it's why he retired.
All right. You want to try this one? If we don't count Johnny Cueto, because he's not currently in the big leagues, there's only one active player with at least 400 career plate appearances and no more than 5 extra base hits. You think you can name that guy? You've watched a lot of his at-bats.
No more than.
He's active.
Boy, this is a disaster.
Kyle Hendricks?
Kyle Hendricks is right.
Okay.
Yeah, 404 plate appearances and 5 extra base hits. Johnny Cueto's 655 with 1.
Oh, wow. Who did he hit it off of? That's impressive.
I don't know. We should dig in on this, right? Maybe the mayor can do some research while we're talking.
Kyle always aspired to hit a big league home run. That was one of his goals, but no.
Alas. Yeah. Jim, I don't know why, but when I think of you, I think of Shohei Ohtani because you're such similar players. Now, he has 38 wins on the mound, so you got him beat there. He has opened a slight edge on you in extra base hits, though. That would be 351 to 0. So what would you say was your greatest similarity to Ohtani?
Left-handed hitter. That's about it. And relatively, we're both tall. That's kind of stops right there, doesn't it? Yeah.
You both have an I in your name. You do have an I in your name. So, yes.
For no apparent reason. Yeah. So you don't think that as people sit in the stands at Dodger Stadium, they think, This guy is so similar to Jim DeShays.
Yeah, if you look, when you go to Baseball Reference and, you know, they do those
similarity scores,
there's pretty good chance that Ohtani's not going to show up under my name and I'm not going to show up under Shohei's name. Who shows up under him? Ruth? Babe Ruth is probably the only one.
Yeah. That's another good question.
I think John Elway shows up on it or something.
Yeah.
Some other sport.
You know what? I think we should look into this. Hold on. Similarity scores. Oh, he's got separate hitting and pitching similarity scores. So
that's not fair.
Hitter, his top three are Pete Alonso, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Ronald Acuna Jr. Pitcher, Jose Fernandez, Shane McClanahan, Walker Buehler. I'm looking down the pitching comps. I don't see you there, but
yeah,
you must be there somewhere, right?
To go deep, 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 deep.
Yeah, if you know, because the list doesn't stop. So I think I'm also on there, on the hitters. Once you get to like 43,212, I think I'm right there.
You guys both known for your long ball skills. Now, Jim, what was the closest that you ever came to an extra base hit? I know I've asked you this before.
Yeah, I like to feel it might have been my very first hit in the big leagues. It was off Joe Price, left-hander, by the way. So I was hanging in there left on
yeah,
left.
Yeah, yeah. Ooh, yeah.
And I hit a little roller down the third baseline that, you know, went over the bag and down the line a little bit. So had I not, you know, I'm just selling out going as fast as I can down the first baseline. So I'm about halfway to right field by the time the play ends. I don't know if the third baseman's going to make a play on me or not. So by the time I turn around and realize that the ball rolled into left field, the opportunity to make a left turn had, you know, had long since passed. But that might have been my best shot.
That was your moment.
Yeah, because the longer I was in the league and the more people saw my swing and, you know, they would just start moving over. I'm pretty sure I've told you before, Jason, that we're in Shea Stadium one night and George Foster is playing left field. And by the time my at-bat ended, he was like, he's like two steps from the left field line. I mean, he just kept, because I just kept hitting the ball foul down there or, you know, just, yeah. So one of the highlights of my hitting career was I pulled the ball to second base in spring training. I think it's the only time in a major league game that I pulled the ball to the right side of the infield. It was off of Ramon Martinez.
Oh, yeah. That's good heat.
And was somebody standing there?
Yeah.
If so, why?
I don't know. Well, they couldn't. I don't know. The shifting wasn't in back then. It was a ground ball to second base. But that was a highlight. That stood out. I was really proud of that.
Yeah. So let's get this straight, though. So you, like 12 years in the big leagues, you never made a left turn at first base?
That's a great question.
Fly ball to left.
I don't think I ever rounded the bag and first base coach didn't have to say, no, stay here. I don't think that ever happened. I think on my hits, it was just like run through the bag or run to the bag. And, you know, maybe I might have taken a step or two, but there was never a chance where I thought I was going to get two on this ball. The outfielders weren't backing up.
Yeah, never got thrown
never
out trying to stretch a single.
No, never a gapper.
What about two-base error? What about, like, scoring runs or stealing bases? Like, what?
I have a picture somewhere. It was like three frames of me scoring a run against the Dodgers with Mike Socia catching. And that was always, because Socia would break your leg. He'd sit on you.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the Astros, we had those, you know, those cardigans that we'd wear. It's like Mr. Rogers, you know, those rainbow cardigans. So I've got pictures of me coming into home and like, Charlie Williams is a home plate umpire and he's calling me safe.
Nice.
And it was like, it should have been safe by a mile, but, you know, I'm rounding third and I'm like, I could have high-fived Lasorda my way to home plate. Such a wide turn. But I got in just ahead of the throw, but it was, you know, he's diving to me and I'm sliding in. So when you look at the picture, you go, wow, that's a pretty athletic play, but it's very deceptive. Just a big giraffe kind of falling into home plate.
Very nice. The slide and everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're a noted clad of dust kind of guy. This just in from the mayor. Johnny Cueto's one extra base hit. I can see why we don't remember. It was June 17th, 2012, Mets against Reds. So he would have been on the Reds. It's described here as a cute double off Chris Young.
Mm. Oh, really?
That's tough to do.
So Chris Young was conspiring to make sure that Jim DeShays kept his record intact.
So Johnny Cueto could hit a high fastball.
Apparently. Exactly. Well, there you go. Hey, Jim, it's always so much fun to talk to you, man, about pretty much anything. Thanks for stopping by Starkville. And as you know, you are welcome back anytime.
I always enjoy a visit to Starkville. It's great to be with you guys.
Strange but true.
Another week, another strange but true week in baseball. So, Doug, what do you say we talk about those New York Yankees? On Saturday in Milwaukee, they laid 15 runs and 19 hits and 4 home runs on the Brewers. And they enjoyed that so much that on Sunday, they put up 15 more runs and 18 more hits and 3 more homers. Would you like to hear a little taste of how they capped that off? Let's hear it.
High fly ball, deep right center. That ball is gone. See ya. Home run number 300 for Anthony Rizzo. A 2-run shot, and the Yankees lead 15-5.
You know it's his 300. You can see the reaction is more than just a home run. 161st player in big league history to hit 300.
Michael Kay on the call for the Yes Network. And let's see here. Let's give you some tidbits, Doug. First off, Anthony Rizzo, 12th active player with 300 homers. 6 of them are first basemen. So that's the place to go hang out if you want to hit 300 bombs. So that's one fun fact. Here's another one I enjoyed. Jose Trevino pitched in that game Saturday, and you might have noticed, Doug, that he is not a pitcher. But also, the Yankees won. Okay, so we had a non-pitcher pitching in a win for the New York Yankees. So, of course, I looked into this. He's the 4th position player in the history of the Yankees franchise to come out of the bullpen and pitch in relief in a game that they won. Now, the last one was Rocky Colavito. Legendary appearance in 1968 because he was actually the winning pitcher, okay? The other two, Johnny Lindell was one back in the 1940s. I would personally overrule him because he pitched over 50 times in his career. I always ignore him. He doesn't count as a true position player for me. So then there's one more, Doug. Want to guess who that would be? It was 1921.
The Babe.
The Babe is the 4th, right? So what a group. If we take Johnny Lindell out of there, it's Babe Ruth, Rocky Colavito, and Trevino. Tremendous. But Doug, hold on now. I'm not finished with the fun facts. Because only 4 other times in the history of the Yankees have they scored 15 runs or more in back-to-back games. Here's the funnest fact. Lou Gehrig played in 3 of those. Okay, so 1930, he and the Babe homered 4 times. They went 17, if I remember, back-to-back. 1936, Lou and DiMaggio were in the lineup for both of those games. 1938, Gehrig, DiMaggio, and Bill Dickey hit 4 bombs in those 2 games. And then the other one, the only other time it happened with no Lou Gehrig involved was 2007. That was more of an A-Rod and Hideki Matsui show. But, Doug, those are my fun facts. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, 15 runs. I mean, well, the thing that's actually been interesting, and my buddy and our friend John Chombi brought up when we were doing the Cubs-Red Sox game on Sunday, he was just curious about, you know, is there a point where you just say, you know, I don't know what you call it, the 10-run rule or something. I know they kind of stay away from mercy rule in Little League nowadays. but, you know, something where you're just like, uncle, it's not a competitive game anymore. Like the Cubs are losing 17-0 and they're pitching, you know, Matt Mervis and all these cats.
Right.
So, you know, so we're just kind of throwing it out there. And I think there's some openness to, you know, what that would mean. Like it sounds, you know, it gives me a little bit of a cringe, like, well, you got to play it out. Remember, you know my college history with our buddy Jim DeShays' Lemoyne College. Like, we blew like a 15-run lead, or a 14-run lead. So I kind of feel like no game is over. But you do wonder, like, what's the value if you're down by 21 or something? and, you know, to just play all nine, I guess. So I don't know if there's an appetite in your travels that somebody's interested in saying this game is over, you could forfeit after seven or something. I don't know, fans may not get their money's worth, but have you heard of any interest out there on that?
It comes up. But I don't think it'll ever happen because you have some concessions that need to be sold in the late innings of those games. What did Craig Counsell think? How would he vote?
He was open to the idea. Obviously, you know, you want to win, and there's a lot of other reasons economically and a lot of considerations. But I just thought it was interesting, like, you know, Craig Counsell's a very deep thinker, so he's like, you know, he's going to weigh everything with consideration. But yes, if you didn't have those economic considerations, as you mentioned, concessions and just the fact that, you know, get over the idea, like you're quitting, you're down by 23, you could come back. But I'm sure the pitchers would be happy. unless, you know, of course, I guess Anthony Rizzo had a great outing against Freddie Freeman, but I know we would miss that.
I'm just going to say, like, we would vote no. We want Jose Trevino to take the mound, okay?
That's right. We just got
him onto a list with Babe Ruth and Rocky Colavito. Don't you think he wants to be on that list?
Well, Starkville would clearly vote against this.
That's right.
But I'm glad the conversation is out there, though. 10-run rule, maybe 15-run rule in this case for the Yankees.
Well, I feel like the best news of all was Aaron Boone didn't get ejected from either one of those games. It's that time again. It's time for listener trivia, our way of involving you, our favorite listeners, in this show. You know what, Doug? We crushed a really tough question last week, so we are back, man. That's two in a row. We didn't even have to resort to any devious Glanville cheating schemes. So, Doug, how impressive was that?
It's good to get back on the rails there. We'd like to live off the rails, but in this case, in trivia, we got to be on the rails and smoothly sail into what we're shooting for, which is 100 in a row. And that's our goal.
Well, in order to get to 100 in a row, we would have to get to 3 in a row by my count.
Yes,
so can we make it 3 in a row? I think we have a shot, man. So let's welcome in this week's special trivia guest star. It's Lindsey Barnes. Lindsey, welcome to Starkville.
Good to be here, Jason. Hi, Doug.
Lindsey, how you doing, man?
I'm all right, thanks. I used you in Immaculate Grid today.
Yeah, I think I...
Well, let's not bring any of that up yet. Doug is a human Immaculate Grid. He's one of those people. All right, I guess we shouldn't go there. I might play this later. But enough about Doug. If I'm not mistaken, Lindsey, you have been here and stumped us before. Am I right?
That is correct. I had asked you about active players with the most gold gloves. And there was one guy who was at that time tied with Yadier Molina with 9.
Oh, it's a Nolan Arenado question.
You narrowed it down to, you got it, Doug. That's right. You narrowed it down to 50-50. So I think this one's gettable, though. So let's see how you do.
All right. That sounds like what we do best. All right. Let's do it. This week's question comes to us via the miracle of X, formerly known as Twitter. But we also got some great ones on my Facebook page and via email at starkville@theathletic.com. So keep those questions coming. But right now, Lindsey, it's your time to hit us with your question.
Okay, Jason. Well, a few weeks ago, we celebrated Jackie Robinson Day and the anniversary of Jackie Robinson's historic debut with the Brooklyn Dodgers. So when you asked for questions about the 300 win club, that got me to thinking, who was the first member of the 300 win club to play his entire career after Jackie Robinson first broke Major League Baseball's color barrier?
That is so good. Lindsey, we love this question. It's really good, very timely, very inventive. So excellent on that, all those counts. Second, just to make sure here. So this pitcher would have to be someone who made his debut from 1947 on, or would have to be a certain date or the year after Jackie's debut?
Made his debut sometime after Jackie Robinson's debut in 1947. Okay. Yes.
Got it. All right. So only one answer. No possibility to use Glanville's Operation Multiple Choice.
Nope.
Doug, you good with that, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm good. I have a policy. This fits well. This is within policy.
All right, we can still do this. We now have a four-minute shot clock. You'll hear it ticking in the background as we thrash this one around here. So let's get rolling. Doug, as I thought about this, I thought all we have to do is concentrate on the great pitchers of the 50s and early 60s, right? So when I thought about it that way, I thought this probably comes down to a choice between two guys. One is Whitey Ford, who won 20 for the Yankees pretty much every year, right? Starting in the early 50s. The other is Warren Spahn, finished his career with the most wins of any left-handed pitcher of modern times. So I think it's one of those two. If I had to lean toward one, I'd lean toward Whitey. He was so good, so young, and for so many years, pitched for those Yankee teams that were always great. And like Warren Spahn, on the other hand, he's famous for, he won so many games in his late 30s and in his 40s. So, like, to me, Whitey Ford feels like the answer. But, Doug, I'm sure you have some names on your list. I'd love to hear them.
Right. Well, because Ford might have beaten Spahn to it. Is that?
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't have a whole lot. I mean, I wasn't sure, you know, okay, yeah, who came in that period, right? I mean, Gibson, when would he debut?
No, he debuted much after those guys.
Yeah. And so it is. It's like that 50s period. I started thinking
about the 50s Yankees, the Boys of Summer. You know, those teams that were in the World Series back in that time. Like, this takes out everybody who, like, pitched in the war. You know, like, I know Bob Feller never got to 300, but those kinds of guys. So it's nobody that fits that profile. It's these pitchers from the 50s, Doug.
50s, yeah. Well, I don't have a better answer. I definitely don't.
You don't?
But
I think we're in a good spot here. So, you know, normally I always feel like we probably talked ourselves out of the right answer. This is one of those rare times. I don't think we did. So you're good with Whitey Ford?
I mean, I had the only people I thought about was his teammates, you know, but then that wouldn't work. So, you know, like someone who was a Dodger after Jackie. You know, like, you know, I was trying to think of that, you know, Drysdale or someone that might have been later.
That's too late. Like, too late. You have to go into that.
Koufax and get it.
Sal Magley, Don Newcomb realm.
Yeah,
but right. Whitey Ford was, he was just cranking out those 200-win years. So, like, we might be wrong about this, but at least it's a great guess.
It's okay. A great guess. All right.
As opposed to most of our guesses. So, we're under a minute. Lindsay? Is there any chance it's Whitey Ford?
So Whitey Ford did make his debut after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. He made his debut July 1st, 1950.
Nice.
However,
did not
get to 300 wins. He's stuck on 236 wins. So the answer is not Whitey Ford.
Okay.
Okay, so maybe it is Warren Spahn then.
Warren Spahn made his debut before Jackie Robinson.
He did?
He debuted in 1942.
42.
5 years before Jackie Robinson's debut.
So we're in trouble now.
Who's left? I mean,
Bob Lemon, early win, like somebody like that?
The answer is Gaylord Perry.
Gaylord Perry?
Gaylord Perry.
Yes, way. What? He made his debut April 14, 1962, almost 15 years to the day after Jackie Robinson's debut. And then 20 years later, got his 300th win, May 6, 1982, with the Mariners.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, when did Gibson debut, by the way?
Bob Gibson made his debut in 1959. Did not make 300 wins, though. 251.
Oh, wow.
All right. Well, Doug, I feel like we should have gotten that. But since we forgot to be born in 1947, I feel like we're off the hook. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I never had Gaylord in the mix, so I mean, that's a great question and a great answer. So I'm happy.
Well, you know what though, Lindsay? As much fun as that was, the fun is only beginning, because this is the portion of this segment where we get the heck out of the way and we bring in the new mayor of Starkville, Brian Smith, for his first ever exercise of official mayoral duties. Brian, what do you got for us?
Yeah, you guys were close, but did not get it. Yeah, we got a little audio here from Gaylord Perry's final out of his 300th career win on May 6, 1982 against the Yankees. He was a current member of the Mariners at that time. And here's the audio.
On May the 6th, 1982, Gaylord Perry, one out away from 300. The 2-1 pitch to Randolph. Swung on, ground ball to Cruz. This should do it. He's got it. It's over. Gaylord has 300. Everybody mobbing Gaylord Perry as he goes all the way. His teammates come out, Bud Bulling, and Gaylord Perry becomes the 15th man in baseball history to win 300 games as the Mariners beat the Yankees 7-3. My, oh, my.
My, oh, my.
My, oh, my.
Give me as many call. My, oh, my's as we can get. That is really good. Brian, that was well done by you. But before we move on here, as we mentioned last week, the upheaval in the mayor's office in Starkville, it just seemed a little, what's the word, Doug, suspicious. So Doug Glanville put his investigative team on this case, and he can now reveal what really happened behind the scenes to force the shocking ouster of Mayor Tim McMaster. So Doug, what have you learned since last week?
Well, it took a little research, and then I had to go back into some old footage. I'd have to go back to 1962. It was a little too far. But I did check into it. And as a big fan of the space program, I talk a lot about the celestial world. I realized that there was a common element here of when the mayor disappeared, the previous mayor, Tim McMaster, and when Brian Smith, our new mayor, had stepped into power. And it wasn't when we thought it was. It was actually a little bit earlier, because there was a doppelganger, sort of a clone in Tim McMaster the last couple of weeks. Why? Because the Tim McMaster we know and love disappeared on the day of totality, the eclipse. So I'm blaming the eclipse. And I found out that amazing fact, Starkville is in the zone of totality for yes. every single eclipse from here to the future. So Tim McMaster has disappeared. It was an imposter all those other weeks after the eclipse, and Brian Smith has taken over. So I don't know when he's coming back, but we'll have to talk to the Martians, find out.
Yeah. You know, it is true. That eclipse changed everything. Day was night. Night was day. Sun was dark. The moon rose in the afternoon. So, Of course, under the mysterious darkness of that day, the mayor disappeared. It's all adding up now. Brian, we have something? Are we on to something?
I can't confirm or deny, but that's a very possible thing.
I feel like it all adds up, Doug. But you know what else adds up? Lindsay had a tremendous question for us.
Great question.
Lindsay, please come back and visit us again, okay?
Anytime. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Lindsay. Good question.
Brian, you're already showing us you're a natural-born mayor. You could easily become the greatest mayor Starkville has ever known.
Only my first weekend, so I'm trying. We'll see. I got some ideas for the town. I got a brewery could be coming up soon.
My for us?
New restaurants, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. All right, let's stay tuned for Mayor Brian's plans for Starkville. Can't wait. Hopefully the statue manufacturing division will be springing into action. It's been a little lax. Okay, that's going to do it for this week's show. Doug, thanks for playing. Thanks to Jim Deshays for visiting us. Thanks to Lindsay Barnes for the great trivia question. Thanks to the new mayor of Starkville, Brian Smith, for producing us and putting up with us. And thanks to you all for listening. Doug and I will see you next week
on Starkville.